The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Just to very quickly introduce myself before I introduce Justin. My name's Tom McAllister. I've known Justin for about 9 years since I signed up for his creative writing class on a whim at LaSalle. And, you know, to say he impressed me at that time would be a gross understatement. It was a class that was very literally life-changing for me. I changed majors. I decided to go to graduate school. I decided to pursue a career as a writer and a teacher. And it's directly because of the influence, because of the environment in this classroom. And I was trying to think of the one thing that stands out about him throughout as a teacher, as a writer, as a friend. And the word I kept coming back to is generosity. As a teacher, remarkably generous with his time. I know others of his students are in here, too, other teachers who've worked with him, too. He is deeply committed to helping people improve their writing, even when perhaps the student's writing is not very good at all. He writes detailed responses to the stories, extra office hours, and he engages with the work in a way and cares so deeply about the writing that he forces you to care about it. It's a contagious kind of affection and love for the prose, which is really kind of inspiring. As a friend, he's always been very supportive of my work and other kind of fledgling authors and seems really invested in trying to help people to build careers. And as a writer, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with this too, his generosity is always on display, not just in the smooth and understated prose where you can see hundreds of hours of painstaking labor went into it, clearly, but in the palpable respect and empathy that he feels for all of his characters, whether it's a young woman contemplating an abortion, as in his award-winning novel and stories, Marion O'Neill, a terminally ill man taking one last trip to his favorite fishing village, as in his novel, The Summer Guest, or if it's a girl who has to save the world from murderous government-created monsters run amok, as in The Passage. You can always tell the reader always knows that Justin cares very deeply about these people and the worlds that he's created. It's really valuable in all the writing. His new book, which most of you have in your laps, The Passage, it's been praised so effusively and in so many places that it would be redundant for me to say much about it. It would be hard for me to keep up with the endorsement of Stephen King, who went out of his way to call into Good Morning America just to say that he hopes it sells a million copies. It's a great book, but you already know that. Everyone in here, I'm sure, has been immersed in it for weeks. It's an amazing book, and it's an amazing success for Justin. Well-deserved success for a great writer and teacher. I'm thrilled to be here to introduce him. It's an honor to be able to introduce him and to be able to have to call him a former teacher and a friend. So please just join me in welcoming Justin Cronin.
I heard all of that from back there. It was very lovely. Thank you all for coming. It's very nice to be back in Philadelphia, where I lived for 11 years. It was the place of my 30s and the 90s for me. And I taught at LaSalle while I was here. And in the last 18 months, in addition to Tom, I've had the opportunity, all told, to read and admire and then offer what help I could to the books of three former LaSalle students. Tom McAllister and Matthew Quick, are you here? Are you here? And Alicia Bissett, all right. Yes, the power couple. So I do hope you buy my book, but please buy theirs, too. They're wonderful new writers, and the proud papa moment. I mean, whatever contribution I made, I'm so proud of you all. I really am. I've been in Philadelphia, back in Philadelphia, for the third time in 7 years, and I've been here for 6 hours. And I've already had three quintessential Philadelphia experiences. I live in Texas now, which is a very different kind of place. And so the three things that happened to me within about 2 hours of arriving was, one, a very well-dressed man on Chestnut Street, apparently with full faculties, was urinating. And I thought that was kind of funny. And then I went into the restaurant at my hotel, and the bartender came up and said, "What do you want, buddy?" And I live in the South now, so that was kind of strange. And then the other thing I noticed was that on the street in Philadelphia, men really check out the women. Like, I was, you know, guys were like, you know? And, I mean, maybe I used to do this, but, you know, you don't do that in Texas because the women have guns, okay, right, in their purses, right? And you just don't do that, all right? I have to begin, actually, with a couple of shout-outs. And this is because I am an extremely lazy namer of my characters. I frequently borrow the names of people that I know, sometimes aware that I'm doing it and sometimes not. And there are a couple of people here who are the beneficiaries or the victims of this to a large degree in the passage. The first is the entire Mulineau family, represented here by Pidge and Nancy in the front row. I promised Pidge, they were my family, and they're still my family, but they were my Philadelphia family. I did all the holidays with them for many years, and I promised her I would put Mulineaus in every book. And the last book, it was a priest, right? And in this, it is a family of warriors. So I hope you are pleased. Now the other, for those of you who know the passage, there is a main character, really a very important character named Brad Wolgast. He's arguably the main character of the book. He is an FBI agent. And I named him Brad Wolgast in about the first 5 minutes of working on the book as a kind of placeholder name. I wanted a name that suggested certain virtues of character. I wanted this to be an admirable man and somebody who is a good dad and somebody we would like and be drawn to. And so I named him for my next door neighbor on Johnson Street in Philadelphia, Brad Wolgast. And I meant to change it later, but I kind of never got around to this. And as happens, it became the name of the character, and there was nothing I could change. So I called him up and I said, listen, I got some news. And I told him about this, and he said, well, Is he a good guy? And I said, yeah, he's like the most important man in the history of civilization in this book. And he said, well, okay, you know, just, you know, give me a shout out. So, Brad, are you here? You're supposed to be here. Where are you? He's not here? He's supposed to, he must have had like a stroke or something. He will come into the room. I hope he does because I have a party favor. Which I will distribute to some people. Unfortunately, I don't have quite enough of these. This was done in a hurry. This was not done by my publisher. This is something I did, my wife and I did. What would Wolgast do? To honor my friend, Special Agent Brad Wolgast. And there he is. There's Agent Wolgast. All right. Who very so very generously loaned me his name. I will also say that he's single, and I'll just leave that there for anybody's. Yeah. All right. Okay, so I'm going to read from the book. The passage is a three-part story, and part one is the end of the world, and part three is a chance to save the world about 100 years later. Part two is a kind of pivot between parts one and three. And it is a single, it's a very short section, and it's a scene set in Philadelphia. Now, I'm thinking some of you have seen this document that I put on your chairs, right? That's a photocopy of a page from the novel. Because I love Philadelphia, I decided it would be the last place to go. So the scene that I'm going to read, the section of the book that I'm going to read, as I said, it's pretty short. It's actually a journal. The original Dracula was a book full of letters and journals and these sort of other documents. And sort of in honor of that, I decided I would have other kinds of documents floating around the novel. And the document that I'm going to be reading is a journal written by a woman named Ida Jackson, who is close to 100 years old, and she is the descendant of, so she's the descendant, she is one of the original children evacuated from Philadelphia, as the, and arguably the oldest person in the world now, and is one who actually remembers the old world and what happened to it. The journal is presented kind of midstream as if it's an archaeological artifact, and in fact, it is. There's a heading on this section that suggests that it's become an important document at some even later date in the future. It's presented as from the Journal of Ida Jackson, parens, the Book of Auntie, presented at the Third Global Conference on the North American Quarantine Period, Center for the Study of Human Cultures and Conflicts, University of New South Wales, Indo-Australian Republic, and then the very mysterious date, 1003 AV. All right, so at some future time, this is being studied and has, in fact, acquired some of the qualities of a gospel. Now, I'm going to read this, and it's a first-person narration because it's a journal. And that offers some challenges because this is a 100-year-old African-American woman from Philadelphia who grew up, lived her life in an isolated mountain community in California. So her voice is going to be, frankly, very different from my own. It has some odd figures of speech. It has some traces of a kind of urban English. It sounds a little bit Philadelphia. It sounds like a lot of different things. So my own voice is not really up to this, and I'm not an actor. So with that as my apology, I will do my very best. It begins midstream, like they're missing a page. And it was chaos. So many years gone by, but you never forget a sight like that. The thousands of people, all of them so frightened, pressing against the fences, the soldiers and dogs trying to keep folks calm, the shots fired in the air. And me, not more than 8 years old, with my little suitcase, the one my mama had packed for me the night before, bawling the whole time because she knew what she was doing, that she was sending me away forever. The jumps had taken New York, Pittsburgh, D.C., most of the whole country, as far as I recall. I had folks in all of those places. There was lots we didn't know, such as what happened to Europe or France or China, though I'd heard my daddy talking to some other men from our street about how the virus was different there. It just flat out killed everyone, so I'm supposing it was possible that Philadelphia was the last city left with people in it in the whole world at that time. We were an island. When I asked my mama about the war, she explained that the jumps were people like you and me, just sick. I'd been sick myself, so it scared me about out of my skin. When she told me this, I just started crying my eyes out, thinking I would wake up one day and kill her and my daddy and my cousins the way the jumps like to do. She hugged me hard and told me, "No, no, Ida, it's different. That's not the same kind of a thing at all. You hush now and stop your crying," which I did. But even so, for a while, it didn't make no sense to me why there was a war on and why there were soldiers everywhere if folks had just come down with a sniffle or something in their throat. That's what we called them, jumps. Not vampires, though you heard the word said. That's what my cousin Terrence said they were. He showed me in a comic that he had, which was a kind of picture book, as I recall. But when I asked my daddy about that and showed him the pictures, he told me, no, vampires were just something in a made-up story, nice-looking men in suits and capes with good manners. And this here's real, Ida. Ain't no story about it. There's lots of names for them now, of course, flyers and smokes and drinks and virals and such. But we called them jumps on account of that's what they did when they got you. They jumped. My daddy said, no matter what you call them, they are some mean sons of bitches. You stay inside like the army says, Ida. It shocked me to hear him speaking such because my daddy was a deacon of the AME and I'd never heard him talk like that, use words of the kind. Nights was the worst of it, especially that winter. We didn't have the lights like we do now. There wasn't much food except what the army gave us, no heat except what you could find to burn. The sun went down and you could feel it, that fear snapping down like a lid on everything. We didn't know if that would be the night the jumps got in. My daddy had boarded up the windows of our house and he kept a gun too, kept it with him all night as he sat at the kitchen table by candlelight, listening to the radio, maybe sipping a bit. He'd been a communications officer in the Navy, and he knew about such things. One night I came in and found him crying, just sitting with his face in his hands and shaking and weeping, the tears all running down his cheeks. Don't know what it was that woke me, except maybe the sound of him. He was a strong man, my daddy, and it shamed me to see him in such a state. I said, "Daddy, what is it? Why are you crying like you are? Did something scare you?" And he shook his head and said, "God don't love us no more, Ida. Maybe it was something we did, but he don't. He's up and flown the coop on us." Then my mama came in and she told him, "Hush up, Monroe, you're drunk," and shooed him back to bed. That was my daddy's name, Monroe Jackson III. My mama was Anita. At the time, I didn't know it, but I think maybe the night he was crying was when he heard about the train. Only the good Lord knows why he spared Philadelphia as long as he did. I barely remember it now, except the feeling of it, time to time. Little things, like stepping out with my daddy at night to get a water ice up the corner, and my friends at school, Joseph Pennell Elementary, and a little girl named Cherise, who lived down the corner from us. The two of us could just keep each other going for hours and hours. I looked for her on the train, but I never did find her. I remember my address, 2121 West Levere. There was a college near there, and stores and busy streets and all sorts of people going to and fro in the day-to-day. And I remember a time when my daddy took me downtown, out of our neighborhood, on the bus to see the windows at Christmas time. I couldn't have been much more than 5 years old. The bus carried us past the hospital where my daddy worked, taking x-rays, which were photographic pictures of people's bones. He'd had that job since he'd gotten out of the service and met my mama, and he always said it was the perfect job for a man like him, how he got to look at the insides of things. He'd wanted to be a doctor, but taking the x-rays was the next best thing. Outside the store, he showed me the windows, all done up fancy for Christmas, with lights and snow and a tree and moving figures inside them, elves and reindeer and such. I'd never been happy like that in all my life, just to see so beautiful a sight, standing in the cold like we were, the two of us together. We were going to pick up a present for Mama, he told me, his big hand on my head like he did, a scarf or maybe gloves. The streets were all full of people, so many people. All different ages and looks to them. I like to think about it even now, to send my mind back to that day. No one remembers Christmas anymore, but it was a bit like first night is now. I don't recall if we got the scarf and gloves or not. Probably we did. That's all gone now, all of it. And stars. Time to time, I think that's what I miss seeing most of all, back in the time before. From the window of my bedroom, I could look over the roofs of the buildings and the houses and see them, these points of light in the sky, hanging there like God, his own self, had strung the sky for Christmas. It was my mama who told me the names for some and how you could watch them a while and start to see pictures up there, simple things like spoons and people and animals. I used to think you could look at the stars and that was God right there, like looking straight into his face. You needed the dark to see him plain. Maybe he forgot us and maybe he didn't. Maybe it was us who forgot when we couldn't see the stars anymore. And to tell the truth, they're the one thing I'd like to see again before I die. There were other trains, I do believe. We'd heard about trains leaving from all over, that other cities had sent them before the jumps got in. Maybe it was just people talking like they do when they're scared, grasping at any bit of hope that floats on past. I don't know how many made it all the way to where they were going. Some were sent to California, some to places with names I don't just now recall. There was only one we ever heard from back in the early days, before the walkers and the one law, when radio was still allowed. Someplace in New Mexico, I do believe it was, but something happened to their lights, and we didn't hear from them again after that. From what Peter and Theo and the others tell me, I do believe we are the only ones left now. But the train in Philadelphia and what all happened that winter was what I meant to write on. Folks were in the worst way. The army was everywhere, not just soldiers, but tanks and other things of the kind. My daddy said they were there to protect us from the jumps, but to me they were just big men with guns, most of them white. And my daddy had always told me to look on the bright side, Ida, but not to trust the white man. That's how he said it, like they was all one man. Though, of course, that seems funny now, folks all blended together like they are. Probably whoever is reading this doesn't even know what I'm talking about. We knew a fellow from up the way got himself shot just for trying to catch a dog. I suppose he thought eating a dog was better than nothing, but the army shot him and strung him up on a light post on Olney Avenue with a sign pinned to his chest that said, "Looter." I don't know what he was trying to loot except maybe a dog that was half-starved and going to die anyway. Then one night we heard the loudest boom, and then another and another, and planes screaming over our heads, and my daddy told me they'd blown the bridges. And all the next day we saw more planes and smelled fire and smoke, and we knew the jumps was close. Whole parts of the city were on fire. I went to bed and woke up later to the sounds of a set to. Our place was just four rooms, and voices had a way of caring. You couldn't sneeze in one room without somebody in another saying, "Bless you." I heard my mama crying and crying, and my father saying to her, "You can't. We have to. You be strong, Anita. Things of the kind." And then the door to my room swung open, and I saw my daddy standing there. He was holding a candle, and I'd never in my life seen him with such a look upon his face, like he'd seen a ghost, and the ghost was his own self. He dressed me quick for the cold and said, "Be good now, Ida, and go say goodbye to your mother." And when I did, she held me a long, long time, crying so hard it makes me hurt to think of it, even now, all these years gone by. I saw the little suitcase by the door, and I said, "Are we going somewhere, Mama? We leaving?" But she didn't answer me. She just went on crying and holding me like she did until my daddy made her let go. Then we left, my daddy and me, just the two of us. It wasn't until we were outside that I realized it was still the middle of the night. It was cold and blowing. Flakes were falling, and I thought it was snow, but when I licked one off my hand, I realized it was ashes. You could smell the smoke, and it was stinging my eyes and throat. We had to walk a long way most of the night. The only things moving on the streets were the army trucks, some of them with horns on top and voices coming out of them telling people not to steal, stay calm, about the evacuation. There were some folks about, but not many, though we saw more and more the further we went until the streets were thick with people, no one saying a word, all walking the same direction as us, carrying their things. I don't think I'd even figured it out in my mind that it was just the littles who were going. It was still dark when we got to the station. I've already said a thing or two about that. My father told me we got there early so as to avoid the lines. He always hated lines, but it was like half the city had the same idea. We waited a long time, but things were turning ugly. You could feel it, like a storm was coming, the air whizzing and cracking with it. Folks was too afraid. The fires were going out. The jumps were coming. That's what people were saying. We could hear great booms in the distance, like thunder and planes flying overhead, fast and low. And each time you saw one, your ears would pop and you'd hear a boom a second after and the ground would shake below your feet. Some folks had littles with them, but not all. My father held my hand tight. There was an opening in the fence where the soldiers were letting people in, and that's what we had to get through. It was so tight that the people pressed together, I could hardly take a breath. "Whatever happens, you hold on to me, Ida," my daddy said. "Just hold on." We got close enough that we could see the train down below us. We were on a bridge, the rails running under it. I tried to follow its length with my eyes, but I couldn't. That's how long it was. It seemed to stretch forever, 100 cars. It didn't look like any train I'd ever seen. The cars didn't have any windows, and long poles stuck out from the sides with nets hanging from them like the wings of a bird. On the roof, there were soldiers with big guns and metal cages like something you'd put a canary in. At least I supposed they were soldiers on account of they were wearing shiny silver suits to protect them from the fires. I don't remember what happened to my father. Certain things you can't remember because your mind won't take them up once they're done and gone. I remember a woman who had a cat in a box and a soldier saying, "Lady, what are you doing with that cat?" And then something happened quick, and believe it or not, that soldier shot her right there. And then there was more shooting and folks tearing about and pushing and screaming, and my daddy and me got separated in all of it. When I reached for my daddy, his hand wasn't there no more. The crowd was moving like a river, dragging me along with it. It was a horrible thing. People was yelling that the train wasn't full, but it was leaving anyway. If you can imagine, I'd lost my suitcase, and that's what I was thinking of. I've lost my suitcase, and my daddy's going to be hopping mad at me for that. He was always saying, "Look after your things, Ida. Don't be careless. We work hard to have the things we do, so don't go treating them like nothing." So I had just about figured I was in the worst trouble of my life, all on account of the suitcase, when somebody knocked me to the ground, and when I got up, I saw all the dead folks around me. And one was a boy I thought I knew from school. Vincent Gumm. That's what we always called him. Vincent Gumm, both names together. And wouldn't you know, that boy was always getting in trouble on account of he liked to chew gum and always had a piece in his mouth at school. But now he had a hole in him, right in the center of his chest, and he was lying on his back on the ground in a puddle of blood. There was more blood coming out of the hole in his chest in little bubbles, like soap in a bath. I remember thinking, that's Vincent Gumm, lying dead right there. A bullet went through his body and killed him. He's never going to move or talk or chew his gum or do nothing at all, and he'll be right there in that spot forever with that forgetful look on his face. I was still on the bridge over the train, and folks were starting to leap down to it. Everybody was screaming. A lot of the soldiers were shooting at them like somebody had told them to just shoot anything, no matter what it was. I looked over the edge and saw the bodies piled up there like logs on a fire, and blood everywhere, so much blood you'd think the world had sprung a leak. Somebody picked me up then. I thought it was my daddy. He'd come to find me after all, but it wasn't. It was just a man, a big, fat, white man with a beard. He snatched me up by the waist and ran to the other side of the bridge where there was a kind of pathway down through the weeds. We were on the top of a wall above the tracks, and the man held me by the hands and lowered me down, and I thought, he's going to drop me and I'm going to die like Vincent Gumm did. I was looking right at that man, and I'll never forget his eyes. They were the eyes of a person who knew he was as good as dead. When you have that look, you're not old or young or black or white or even a man or a woman. You're gone from all those things. He was yelling, somebody take her, somebody take this girl here. And then somebody grabbed my legs from below and lifted me down. And the next thing I knew, I was on the train and it was moving. And somewhere in there, I came to think I'd never be seeing any of them again, not my mama or daddy or anybody I had known in my life to that day. What I remember after that is more like a feeling than any actual thing. I remember children crying and being hungry and the dark and heat and smell of bodies all crammed in. We could hear gunfire outside and feel the heat from the fires passing through the walls of the train like the whole world was on fire. Some of the children weren't no more than 4 years old, practically babies. We had two watchers in the car with us, a man and a woman. I don't remember what became of the woman, but that man was first family, a chow. He married another watcher, and after she died, he had two other wives. One of those wives was Maisie Chow, old Chow's grandmother. But the thing was, the train didn't stop, not for anything. Time to time, we'd hear a great big boom, and the car would shake like a leaf in the wind, but still we kept right on. One day, the woman left the car and went back to help with some of the other children and came back, all crying. I heard her tell the man that the other cars behind us were gone. They'd built the train so that if the jumps got into a car, they could leave it behind. And those were the booms we'd heard, one car after another falling away. I didn't want to think about those cars and the children inside them, and to this day I don't. So I'm not going to write anything about that now. What you'll want to know about is when we got here, and I do remember something of that because that was how I found Terrence, my cousin. I didn't know he was on the train with me, and it was a lucky thing he'd been in one of the cars at the back, because by the time we arrived, there weren't no more than three, and two mostly empty. We were in California, the watchers told us. California wasn't a state like it used to be, they said. It was a whole different country. Buses would be meeting us to take us up the mountain, someplace safe. The train slowed to a stop, and everyone was afraid, but excited, too, to be getting off the train after all the days and days. And then the door opened, and the light was so bright, we all had to hold our hands over our faces. Some of the children were crying because they thought it was the jumps. The jumps were coming to get us, and somebody said, "Don't be stupid, it ain't the jumps." And when I opened my eyes, I was relieved to see a soldier standing there. We were someplace in the desert. They took us off, and there were lots more soldiers around, and a line of buses parked in the sand, and helicopters thwacking overhead, stirring up the dust all around and making every kind of a racket. They gave us water to drink, cold water. All my days, I've never been so glad just to taste cold water. The light was so bright to my eyes, it still hurt me even to look around, but that's when I saw Terrence. He was standing there in the dust like the rest of us, holding a suitcase and a dirty pillow. I had never hugged a boy so hard or long in my life, and we were both laughing and crying and saying, "Look at you." We weren't first cousins, but more like second, as I recall. His father was my daddy's nephew, Carlton Jackson. Carlton was a welder at the shipyard, and Terrence later told me his daddy was one of the men who built the train. A day before the evacuation, Uncle Carlton had taken Terence to the station and put him in the engine car closest to driver and told him to stay there. You stay put, Terence. Do what driver tells you. So that was how Terence had come to be with me now. He was just 3 years older than me, but it seemed like more at the time, so I said to him, you'll look after me, won't you, Terence? Say you'll do that. And he nodded and said yes, he would, and that was just what he did until the day he died. They loaded us onto the buses. Everything felt different to me with Terence there. He lent me his pillow to use, and I fell asleep with my head leaned against him. So I couldn't say how long we were in the buses, though I don't think it was more than a day. Then before I knew it, Terence was saying, wake up, Ida, we're here, wake up now. And right away I could smell how different the air was. More soldiers took us off, and for the first time I saw the walls and the lights above us standing high on their poles, though it was still the daytime, so they weren't on. The air was fresh and bright and so cold, all of us were stamping our feet and shivering. There was army everywhere and FEMA trucks of all sizes full of every kind of thing, food and guns and toilet paper and clothes, and some with animals in them, sheep and goats and horses and chickens in cages, even some dogs. The watchers put us all in lines like they'd done before and took our names and gave us clean clothes and took us to the sanctuary. The room they put us in was the one most everyone knows, where all the littles sleep to this very day. I took a cot next to Terence and asked him the question that was on my mind, which is, what is this place, Terence? Your daddy must have told you if he built the train. And Terence was very still for a moment and said, this is where we live now. The lights and walls will keep us safe, safe from the jumps, safe from everything until the war is over. It's like the story of Noah, and this here's the ark. I asked him, what ark, and what are you talking about, and will I ever see my mama and daddy again? And he said, I don't know, Ida, but I'll look after you, like I said. Sitting on the bed on the other side was a girl no older than me who was just crying and crying, and Terence went to her and said quietly, what's your name? And I'll look after you too if you want, which made her stop. She was a beauty, that one. You could see it plain as day, even as dirty and worn down as all of us were. The sweetest little face and hair so light and wispy, it was like a baby's the way they do. She nodded and answered, yes, would you please do that? And if it's not too much trouble, can you look after my brother too? And wouldn't you know, that girl, Lucy Fisher, became my very best friend and was the one that Terence married later on. Her brother was Rex, a little bit of a thing who was just as pretty as Lucy, except in the manner of a boy. And I'm guessing you probably know that Fisher's and Jackson's been mixed up together one way or another ever since. Nobody said it was my job to remember all these things, but it seems to me that without me to put them down, they'd all be gone by now. Not just how we came to be here, but that world, the old world of the time before. Buying gloves and a scarf at Christmas and walking with my daddy up the block for water ice and sitting in a window on a summer night to watch the stars come on. They're all dead now, of course, the first ones. Most have been dead so long or else taken up, but no one even remembers their names anymore. When I think back on those days, it's not sadness I feel, a little sadness for missing folks like Terence, who was taken up at 27, and Lucy, who died in childbirth not long after, and Maisie Chow, who did live a good while but passed in a manner I don't just now recall. The hardest to think on are the ones who let it go the way so many did over the years, the ones who took it into their own hands from sadness or worry or just not wanting to carry the weight of this life no more. They the ones I dream on, like they left the world unfinished and don't even know they've gone. But I suppose it's part of being old to feel that way, half in one world and half in the other, all of it mixed together in my mind. No one's left who even knows my name. Folks call me Auntie on account of I never could have children of my own, and I guess that suits me fine. Sometimes it's like I've got so many people inside me, I'm never alone at all. And when I go, I'll be taking them with me. The watchers told us the army would come back, bringing more children and soldiers, but they never did. The buses and trucks pulled away, and as darkness settled down, they sealed the gates, and then the lights came on, bright as day, so bright they blotted out the stars. It was a sight to see. Terence and I had gone back outside to look, the two of us shivering in the cold, and I knew then that what he said was so. This was where we would live from now on. We were there together on first night when the lights came on and the stars went out. And in all the years since then, the years and years and years, I never have seen those stars again, not once. Thanks. This is the question period. Yes, I think it is the question period. So there's a microphone. There's a woman and a microphone. And another woman and a microphone. All right, you're surrounded. There we go. Hey, Mark, how are you? Yes. The gentleman who asked this question actually is my former neighbor in Houston, Texas, and knows my daughter. And indeed, yes, our daughters went to elementary school together. My daughter, Iris, who some of you knew as a baby and then as a young little person, who's now 13, which is, of course, you know, the new 30. Yes, when she was 8, she told me that she was concerned that my writing was not living up to its potential, and that my books were probably boring, and she said, why don't you write a story about a girl who saves the world? And that was in the fall of third grade. It was third grade. And we spent that about an hour every day after school. I would take my run through the flat, shady, wide sidewalk neighborhoods of Bunker Hill, Texas, and Iris would follow me on her bicycle, and we built a plot together. I mean, I have some former students in the room, do I not? Does anybody remember Bob and Lorna? An old creative writing exercise I used to do, where we just sort of make a story out of nothing, right? That was basically what I did, although I didn't do it with a college student. I did it with an 8-year-old. And after about 3 months, when the weather got cold and Iris had to move on to other things, I sat down to sort of write up what we'd come up with, and I realized I had 30 pages, single-spaced pages of notes. And I decided I would write a chapter, and that became the passage. So if you are a writer, go get yourself a kid, basically, is what I'm saying. Anybody else? The always challenging question and answer period, right over there. Yeah. Yeah. Hey.
It's great to have you here. Were you a fantasy science fiction-y kind of kid?
Yes, I was. I think all kids are, aren't they? Even if they don't read, they nevertheless are, you know? Yeah, I grew up on a steady diet of mostly science fiction, not really fantasy. I've never actually been that taken by books involving magic. I was more interested in purely speculative science fiction. And back then, there were fewer books for young people to read. Now that is a bona fide category, and there's an awful lot of things for kids to choose from. The YA sections are kind of busting at the seams. But back then, not so much. And the first writer that I kind of, you know, that sort of grabbed me, and I read all of his books, because he actually wrote a series of novels that were essentially, you know, YA, was Robert Heinlein, who wrote, you know, Space Cadet and Stormship Troopers and Orphans of the Sky and all these books. And a friend of mine in the fifth grade, I still remember, he's now a psychologist at UCLA. He found me on Facebook. And he and I were both equally enchanted by this bright, promising future in which by the miraculous year 2000, we would all be taking vacations on Mars. I'm really disappointed this future did not actually unfold in quite the way we'd hoped. But he was the guy who turned me on to these books. And then also a lot of post-apocalyptic fiction, which was kind of the thing I graduated to next. And then, of course, more grown-up science fiction. The first grown-up sci-fi novel I read was Michael Crichton's Andromeda Strain, which was, I mean, I think a new book at that time. I didn't understand all of it. The science was kind of over my head, but it was really thrilling and, kind of opened up a whole world of more grown-up books for me, science fiction. But I also read a lot of other sort of genre novels. I got a hold of my books every year at the used paperback book sale at my school, where for $5 you get a grocery sack full. And it was kind of like the fat paperbacks of the day, too. So in addition to reading all the sci-fi, I also read Jaws, right? And The Day of the Jackal. Right. And so Westerns and, you know, thrillers and adventure stories. And it was a great experience because I didn't have any sort of inner critic telling me what I should or should not read. I just read what I liked. And was the cover interesting, you know? The one book that I tried to read that I was then denied was Valley of the Dolls, which was confiscated. Yeah. I still don't know how that all works out, but, you know. Hey, yeah.
How did you end up with it being the length that it did? Mm-hmm. And didn't your agent tell you to make it shorter?
No, nobody ever told me to make it short. Well, maybe my editor did. He's in the front row. Ask him. When we shot the manuscript, when we sent the book out into the world, it was a partial, and I already knew that it was going to be at least 1,000 pages in manuscript form, which, you know, then becomes something else when it's an actual book. And nobody ever raised the question of making it shorter. There's substantial evidence that in the last few years, kind of big books have come back, and I wanted to write one like that. I wanted to write a book where I kind of didn't say no to myself in terms of plot and character. I just wanted to write a big, fat, juicy book that you could live with for a few weeks, where the emphasis was not on leaving things out, but kind of enjoying putting things in. I think that this what happened, even as our attention spans have gotten shorter, and they have, you know, we're all you know, tweeting, right, which is, you know, how many words or, you know, characters long. At the same time, I think actually episodic television has also reawakened in us an appetite for longer sustained narrative. There's wonderful writing going on television. I think The Sopranos was the series that kind of opened this door. Essentially, everybody who watched The Sopranos was reading Dostoevsky and they didn't know it. Right. And many series have followed since, like The Wire and, you know, there's Lost. There's plenty of them and they operate in different genres. But they're stories that people will stay with for years. And this has made it, it sort of retaught us how to enjoy an extremely long story. And so I had no hesitation about it. As far as I know, nobody ever told me to shut up. And not even my wife, you know. So I guess that's the answer, yeah. In the back.
Your writing is very, very descriptive and very, very clear and very engaging. One thing that I was really impressed by from the passage that you just read was the way that you unfolded your character. What's your process for fleshing out your characters?
I actually have two. It's always different. Depends on the character and the situation. But I actually have two rules that I follow as kind of guideposts when I'm creating an imaginary friend, essentially. And one is that I have to know what they're not telling anybody. I have to know what their secret is. And when I know that, their humanity kind of lights up in front of me. Right? And the character of Ida Jackson is somebody whose whole life is actually a secret. Nobody's like paying any attention to her anymore. She's got all these old stories with nowhere to put them, so she puts them in a journal. In a sense, the piece that I just read was one long secret about a past that people have forgotten and don't really care about anymore. The other thing I like to do is, as quickly as I can, I put them in a situation where I can watch what they will do when they have to make a choice that can't be unchosen. Right, some situation where they will perform an action that will make them sort of permanently more themselves. And so you have to really sort of create a character, you need to have the character be in motion. Right, they have to be a dramatic entity where they're doing things, and by what they do, being themselves. Right, and those are the kind of two things I keep in mind. And other than that, just concentrate really hard on who this other person is. I mean, I think it's kind of my job as a writer to imagine the interior lives of people who are not at all like me. And that's if you can write about people who are yourself, I think just once, it's your autobiographical novel or your memoir. But after that, you really have to go out and work with all kinds of different people. And the passage was for me a chance to do that with a huge range of people. I mean, not only these people who have lived in isolation in a mountain community and
in California who have no reference points that I share. I mean, they live a completely different existence. But also the characters in the beginning of the novel, which include a mystic nun from Sierra Leone, a man on death row, he's a homeless man from Texas, an FBI agent, a paroled sex offender, who works as a janitor at this facility, and then a guy who's arguably a kind of assassin, like the first real villain I ever created. And each time I went into one of these characters, I decided for the moment that I would have to love them like the story's local god, even if they were full of wickedness, and be as, let them have sort of the dignity of being complete people. I discovered very quickly that everybody in my story had a good side and a bad side. That's the other thing to do, is you make sure that you put some opposites into them, because that's who people really are. You know, nobody's ever just one thing. That charming, sweet kindergarten teacher has a gambling problem, right? You know what I mean? Yeah. And all this, that's a person, okay? That's not a stereotype. That's not a cliche. That's a human being. So that's the other thing I like to do, is I put a little bit of the opposite, at least, into each character that I make. And I think I've said this to my students before, those of you who have actually passed through a classroom with me.
My son would like to know what inspired you to be a writer, and I'd like to know what you think about Kindle with the size book that you made.
Kindle. Okay, my editor's in the room, so what do I say about Kindle? I've sold a lot of books on Kindle because the passage is really super long, okay, and I think it's like the perfect thing to download as an ebook. I don't use Kindle personally because the reading experience is still, I've been reading books too long in a sense, it's still really tied to a physical object in my hand that changes weight. My right hand gets lighter and my left hand gets heavier, and this tells me something about where I am in the story, which may sound crazy, but I think it's really true. I have a Kindle that somebody gave me, and I do use it when I travel, so it makes a lot of sense, right? Now that you can't have a piece of luggage that's over 50 pounds, right? I think we're obviously in a transition between where books and ebooks are going to have to kind of successfully cohabitate, that's what I know. I write books. How they actually get read, that's kind of out of somebody else's hands, and the sort of economic model of it and what it'll do to how many books get published and what they cost and so on. I do think that the fact that you can take one of those devices wherever you are, as long as you're in cell phone range, and literally suck a book into it out of space, is probably on the whole a great thing for reading. I think that's probably true, because if you hear about a book, you don't have to go find it. It can find you almost instantly, and I think that's very cool. What inspired me to be a writer was that I became increasingly bad at everything else. It was the thing that I got rewarded for, and for everything else, I was basically punished. So what was I going to do, and I couldn't afford to go to journalism school. I applied to graduate school. I was a high school teacher, and that kind of didn't suit me all that well. I wanted to go do something else, so I applied to journalism school and some writing workshop, graduate writing programs, when I was 24. And I'd written a few short stories. That was about it. And I got into both. And J School wanted me to write them a check for $25,000. And I think I had like $20 in my bank account, And I got a tuition scholarship and assistantship at the Iowa Writers Workshop. So it was free, basically. So I went there. That's pretty much it right there. Yeah. We'll get one in the back too. Okay. I'm not in charge. Here we go. There and then back there? Okay, yeah.
You previously hinted that two more books were to follow, though it's not necessarily going to be a series.
Right.
Did you map these out with your daughter as well? And if so, will they follow a similar theme and concepts?
Yeah. What I did was I figured out the first book, and then I realized that that to tell the whole story the way I really wanted to do it, I had two more novels that I could and should write. The outline for the first book was more complete and detailed, because to write a very detailed outline of numbers 2 and 3 would have been something of a waste of time, because I knew the terms of the story would change a little bit and my sense of it would grow over, 2 or 3 years of writing it. But I had a very firm kind of general outline for each of these books. And I'm writing the second one now. It now possesses an extremely detailed outline. And when I say outline, that sounds like something you do in middle school. It's not really like that. It's kind of like, you know, sort of a long letter to myself with, you know, what's that? Well, no, not really. I finally came to the idea of planning novels pretty late. And it helped me enormously. Actually, you know, I'd been for a long time wondering how I would go about writing a novel. And one of my former teachers was in my house. We were sitting there drinking whiskey and I was doing an interview for him for a magazine. And I asked him, like, do you just kind of sit down and let it all, you know, come to you and let the angels sing? And, you know, and he said, are you kidding me? You know, he said, writing a novel is like launching a missile. If you don't aim it very carefully at the start, you will kill all your friends in France. And it sort of wake up for me. And then ever since then, I've been very much a planner. Different people do this just differently, but I like to have a pretty detailed map of where I'm going to go. The other two books do have such maps now. The second one's very detailed. The third is still, you know, it's kind of general, but I know what it is. And each of the books is going to be, to the best of my abilities, a good freestanding novel. I like the idea of three books in the same world that together add up to a somewhat richer story, but that each of the books by itself should be a real book. In trilogies, there's a tendency for the middle book to be kind of a fake book, right? We all know this. It's just kind of a way of getting from one to three, and that's okay. But, I thought I could do something that was a little better, and so each of the books will... This is what I'll tell you. It's not really a spoiler, but in each of the books, you'll go back to the year zero briefly, and you'll see something that you either didn't see the first time or saw only out of the corner of your eye that resets the terms for my characters, so that when we rejoin them on their journey to save humanity, they're encountering something that they didn't expect. So each book will sort of shift a little bit, right? And that way I felt like I could make each book by itself a kind of complete experience as opposed to just a way of getting from one to the next. The next question was in the rear of the room. Yeah.
Hi. I had your creative writing class about 15 years ago, so it's...
How you doing?
Yeah. Pretty good. Right. It's nice to see you. I'm really glad that you're doing very well.
And, thank you.
It's going to be a pleasure to read this book. From what I understand, this is going to be made into a movie.
Yes.
Will you have any creative input into the movie?
Yes, I wrote the novel, which is extremely helpful. I know what you're asking, and the answer is yes. First of all, whenever you go to a movie, everybody's an executive producer. I think technically I am one, and you know, you can do that without ever being in the same zip code as the movie. But the people who are involved with it, it's Ridley Scott, and the screenwriter is John Logan, who wrote Gladiator for Ridley Scott, among other things, and he also just won Best Play on Broadway for Red. Has anybody seen this play? Oh, it's awesome. And so this is a very, very talented and smart group of people. The role that I have played so far is telling them about this, really sort of talking about the first book to just sort of like kind of, so we can all just sort of get a richer understanding of it, you know, and because they're coming to it without sort of the full knowledge of what I know and what I've been trying to do with the book. But also talking about the other stories, volumes 2 and 3 or novels 2 and 3, because they don't want to get into a position where in order to compress this story effectively for a 2.5-hour movie, because they're talking about 2.5 hours, that they can't make a movie of the second book. I think the idea here is that this is a potentially a 3-movie franchise property, as The Passage is a 3-novel idea. And so they have to know more about what's coming than anybody else in the world. Basically, John Logan and my wife are the only two people who know. So if I, you know, get hit by a bus tomorrow, that's who people need to talk to, because they're the only ones who've got it. And so that's been my role, and it is a satisfying one, you know, because it's useful. It's something I can do that they can't, and I'm not trying to. I don't want to interfere. These are experts. I mean, he wrote Gladiator. He knows how to write a screenplay, and I don't. I've never written one, so I don't want to. I don't want to insert myself into their process in the same way that I want my process to be sort of safe and my own. So that's what I've gotten to do so far. It's also just really cool to like fly to LA and meet Ridley Scott. That's the other thing I got to do. Right? No, that was awesome. Yeah. And you think it's going to be weird. You think you're going to like go in and you're going to lie on adjacent massage tables or something, And it's not like you just like sit at a conference table in an office. It's like, yeah, Hollywood's a business. So some of the mystique is worn off slightly, but, they told me to park on the street too. What's up with that? I don't know. The street the office was on, like, well, the lot's full. But I wrote the passage. No. Yeah, in the back.
When's the movie due to be released?
Well, what they're doing now is they're trying to get a sort of effective first script. And I think the ideal timeline is one where it's, a year, 2 years. Movies are like, like invading France, it's they need caterers. The stuff that goes into this, I'm just sort of getting a sense of it, is they can't just say, okay, let's go make the movie now. It has to do with getting people's schedules together. Casting is also a question of, they need to know how much my characters were going to age, for instance, in the later franchises, in the later books. So they have to make some decisions based upon like who would be available to do three movies. It's very complicated, and they have to like build a whole town in New Zealand and burn it down and stuff. It's very complicated and very expensive. So I think the best hope is probably about a 2-year schedule, but beyond that, I couldn't say. I get to go to one red carpet premiere. It's in the contract. And everybody's like, oh, he's a novelist. Forget that, One more? We're at 8:30. Yeah. No. No, practically speaking, no writer ever actually does. It's a very complicated legal relationship where you just got to trust the people. Everybody's got to trust each other is the best way to make this work. There are specific things when they make an adaptation that they can and cannot do. This is strange, but they are not allowed to kill or maim any character that I do not kill or maim. And it's actually described like that. Unless they kill a character, they can't do it. And so there's specific things like that. But at the end of the day, the whole thing operates best when people respect and trust each other to make make the best art that they can. One more. Nancy. Right on.
Since we're going to be first in line to see this movie, who would you like to see play Wolgast?
that's a good question. I actually thought that Russell Crowe would be good because you have the triangle there, And Russell Crowe has shifted from, I guess I haven't seen Robin Hood, but in a number of movies, he's sort of shifted away from being the kind of gladiator action hero to playing essentially middle-aged guys, with a sort of crusading heart, but maybe a drinking problem, and I think that's actually a very good, that's a very good combination, and he would really suit that role. Other than that, for other characters, it's hard to say because the role of Amy, the girl who saves the world, is one where she exists at several different ages, And so, obviously, the young Amy, the 6-year-old Amy, would be an unknown. Because she's probably 2 now. What's that? He'd be okay, right over here. And then there's the adolescent Amy, that's somebody who we probably don't even know yet. And then, of course, there's an older Amy, and that, I actually have an idea for who that might be, but I don't want to give too much away because it tells you too much actually about the story and what becomes of her. But to answer your question, I think Russell Crowe would be a kick-ass Wolgast. And the original Wolgast looks a lot like Russell Crowe, too. I think we can all agree on that. My brother. All right. So I leave you with this thought. What would Wolgast do? All right. Thank you all for coming. I'm going to sign a few books, and happy to chat and see you all. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.